To have a little fun and a lot of meaning this morning. Conversation on God sounds kind of heavy, perhaps. It might have been called conversation on, oh God. The movie. Have you seen the movie? How many of you have? We mean to use that as a takeoff point for some of our talk this morning. And I've invited the two resource people that you see on my left and right to participate in this, and I need to explain to you on what terms and with what understanding they're here. Walt Bowman, you probably know, is the dean of the faculty here at Holden this summer, is usually a teacher of systematic theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Columbus. Wolfgang Roth is our Bible faculty person these weeks, teaches at Garrett Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. The understanding with which they're here is that they don't yet know what we're going to talk about. It wasn't that I wasn't willing to tell them, it's that they really didn't want to know, because then they'd have to spend all that time spinning their wheels and thinking and making coherent presentations. And that wouldn't be as much fun as what we hope will happen. I'm going to read in this time slot today and tomorrow a few sections from the book, the novel, O God, and then I'm going to identify a central or fundamental question that arises out of that and invite each of them to address it at whatever length they will, and then we'll simply open it to our general conversation.
Phil, may I make an inquiry? Is the press representing?
Wolfgang informs me that he has seen the movie. Walt has not. So this will be very interesting. But many of you have seen it, and you know that the movie is about a man who, without ever intending it or wanting it, has an interview with God. It was God who intended it and who wanted it. And if you keep in mind who played the role of God, you have some idea of the part. George Burns. George Burns played God. He appears in a fisherman's cap and a windbreaker and a see-through plastic raincoat and sneakers. He encounters John. I'll call him John. I don't know if he had a name in the movie. He doesn't in the novel, because it's written in the first person. It's autobiographical. But John Denver played the other person. John encountered him going across the street one day, and lo and behold, he was the good humor man. And when John figured out who this was, that it was the person he'd met before as God, he exclaimed, "Good God!" And God said, "Good humor." So it's that kind of thing. Richard Schickel, who reviews for Time, said, "If you were God and chose to manifest yourself on earth, wouldn't you give serious consideration to appearing as George Burns?" He admits that he's made a few mistakes. Giraffes were a mistake. Avocados were a mistake. The pits are too large. When someone calls him profound or says, "That's profound," God replies, "Sometimes I get lucky." John Denver plays the role of the reluctant modern Moses, the man who is interviewed by God, and you can imagine the reaction of his wife, Judy. She's both very understanding and forbearing, but pretty skeptical, almost to the end. The media get hold of it, and of course they're not willing to handle it, until, at the end of NBC Nightly News, David Brinkley, just to play it safe, mentions that this has happened. If this is really true, he doesn't want to be caught having missed the story on God appearing to a man. So he just mentions it very, but with that, of course, the media pick it up, and there are press conferences all over the place. In the end, an all-faith international conference is convened to discuss whether this miracle really happened or not, and they vote 1,459 to 332 with 211 abstentions that this miracle really did not happen. And so the world's religious leaders have voted against God. It's a light movie, it's not heavy and preachy, it, as someone says, tugs at your arm rather than blasting your ear. It's a nice movie about some nice people who have been made in the image of a very nice Jehovah. Let me take some time now just to read. I really should have had Ruth Schultz set this up and stage it in some way, but I'll do the best I can. He is a writer, a creative artist, a playwright who has two full-length plays written, but unfortunately no producer or director has shown enough interest in them. So he's gotten into some interviews with some show business personalities, and he did an exciting piece on a press conference that the Rolling Stones had. And that was printed in the Times, and that got him quite famous, and the mail has begun to pour in. And on this particular morning, his wife, who has left to go to work, he's a writer, she makes about $12,000 a year, and he earns $5,500 freelancing. Judy has dropped the bundle of mail on his bed. I started to go through the mail, and in among the junk was an envelope addressed to me with no return address. Inside was a sheet of plain white bond paper, and typed on an electric typewriter, it said, "God grants you an interview. Go to 600 Madison Avenue, room 3700, at 11 a.m. My first thought was that it was a press agent stunt, or maybe it was a teaser mailing, or a prank. It couldn't be God. God was God. Also, I was brought up on something called Bible comics, true-to-life adventures of biblical heroes, and there were wonderful things like David and Goliath, and God and Moses, and God was always pretty impressive, talking from the heavens or booming down his voice from mountaintops, all of which made an early impression on me. So the idea of a typed letter from an executive God didn't make much sense. There was even a typo in the V in Avenue, just a little mistake, but a mistake nonetheless, only I couldn't begin to deal with the possible metaphysical implications of that. But what was it? It was a gimmick, a Florida land scheme, and they get you up there and show you a movie of condominiums in paradise. It was a nut. He gets you up there and undresses. I called Judy for an opinion, but she was out of the office somewhere, so it was up to me. God was granting me an interview at 11 a.m., and it was already 10. I just didn't know what to make of it. There was something peculiar about it. No press agent or businessman would send out an invitation like that with such little information in it. Only somebody very crazy, or very dumb, or very sure of himself. Could it possibly be God? It couldn't. But if it were God, it could have been God. God can do anything. A line that John Updike once wrote flashed across my mind about Ted Williams not acknowledging the Boston fans in his last game. He wrote, "Gods do not answer letters." But I couldn't remember anybody ever saying anything about their sending them. Well, whoever it was had done a job on me. I was curious. No, that's too casual. Deep down, I must have hoped, it is God. It's this incredible miracle, and I'm in on it. And what if it were this incredible thing? What if God had chosen me? How would I deal with it? What could I possibly say to him? Like most people, I had wondered about God and the universe and the nature of things, but I wasn't a theological scholar. Apart from those Bible comics and Hebrew school, which I almost flunked, the deepest I ever went on God was in late-night discussions with girls I was trying to seduce after seeing Ingmar Bergman movies. I didn't know what to do. Miracles don't happen, except when they happen, if they happen. I went through a truly Baroque reasoning process and finally came up with, go. If it's a stunt, maybe you'll get a story out of it. And if it's real, try not to think about it. It's called confronting a dilemma sideways. On the bus uptown, I began feeling alternately foolish about going and apprehensive about what I was getting into. By the time I reached 600 Madison, I was in a totally confused state, deterred momentarily by the sight of a U.S. mail truck with a poster on the side, "Join the Modern Coast Guard," and thinking maybe I should have. I took the elevator to the 37th floor and followed an arrow which pointed to room 3700. There was no name on the door, just the numerals 3700. I knocked, waited, and then tried the door. It was open, and I went in. The office was empty except for a chair and an intercom machine on the floor. Then from the intercom there came this voice. It was his voice. Yes, himself, himself. The voice wasn't booming and spectacular, George Burns,
It was just a voice, a little weary, a little whiny, actually. And God's first words to me were, "Listen, I like the piece you did on the Rolling Stones." "Who are you? What is this?" "I'm God." "This is crazy." "Be nice," he said.
"You're God?"
"It couldn't be," I thought. "It is," he said.
"How can you be God? You're a voice on an intercom."
"Well, you're not allowed to see me."
"Why not?"
"Because."
"It's just not possible."
"It's possible."
"Prove it. Prove you're God."
"I don't do proof."
"I'm getting out of here."
"Wait, where are you?" "Room 3700, 600 Madison Avenue." "So you know what? In this building there is no room 3700. I got out of there. A person can take just so much weirdness. I took the elevator down to the lobby and looked around. The sign over the elevator said 12 to 26. The other one said 2 to 11. I was sure I had seen something when I first came in that said 12 to 37. I asked the elevator starter, "How did I get to 3700? And he said, "There is no 3700. And I almost fainted. I was tempted to leave then and there, but I couldn't. I went back in the elevator, pressed the button for 26, and when the elevator stopped, I was facing a sign that said 37th floor. I walked down the hall, opened the door to 3700, and the voice said, "So stop this riding up and down." I want to tell you that I was pretty scared. "Don't be scared," he said. "I went to a lot of trouble, so you wouldn't be."
"What is this?"
"What this is an interview. I am God, and you are you, and I'm giving you an exclusive."
"You can't be God."
"You know this for a fact?"
"God wouldn't do this. He wouldn't invite someone to a strange room like this."
"You know what your trouble is?"
"I'm hallucinating. That's my trouble."
"You've read too many Bible comics."
"If you're God..."
"Imagine saying that to God."
"If you're God, then why all this? Why didn't you just appear over my bed?"
"Because you'd get too frightened. You'd probably jump out the window."
"If you're God, how come you've got such a thin little voice? If you're God, how come you talk a little whiny, a little like my Uncle Simon?"
"Empathy," he said.
"What?"
"What I'm doing. I'm talking to you in a way you can accept. I'm relating."
"Relating?"
"Well, I don't want to brag, but if I appeared to you just as God, your mind couldn't grasp it." "My mind wasn't doing such a good job as it was."
"And the letter and this meeting?"
"To bring you along gradually, so you can cope."
"Well, I don't believe any of this."
"That's the whole problem. That's why I decided to show up. Too many non-believers." I was bewildered. "Come on. Be a good reporter. This is the biggest story of your life."
"I think you should talk to James Reston."
"No, you're the fella."
"That piece on the Stones. I liked it a lot. Peppy. Today you need peppy in order to communicate. And I want to communicate." What I said next was, "Why?"
I guess what was working on me was some residual belief that there is a God, and it could be God. And if it is God, you go along with him, don't you? He's God. So I asked, "Why?" And right there, I was into it. God had finessed me into an interview. I dimly remember from my high school Spanish textbook a story that passed for humor. A teacher asks a class, "Is God everywhere?" And the children say, "Yes, God is in the heavens, in the fields, and in the houses." One little boy insists God may be everywhere, but not in his basement. It turns out God is not in his basement because he has no basement. We have a basement, and God was in it. We live in the ground floor apartment of a brownstone in Manhattan. Judy was taking a nap, and I was working in my room when I noticed the desk lamp flickering I went downstairs to check the fuse box, and there, coming out of the hot water heater, was his voice. Hey, it's me, God. You know those comic strips where somebody gets so scared his hair stands on end? You're going to give me a heart attack, I said. Don't worry, he said, which is better than Blue Cross. I've got to meet you here. Outside, there are too many reporters following you. I suppose, but this is very hard to grasp. How do I relate to a hot water heater? I'll tell you what, go upstairs and see if your wife is sleeping. I went back upstairs and saw that Judy was sleeping soundly. Then I came downstairs again. That's when it happened. He was actually standing there, God in person. How do you conceive of God? A tall man in a long white beard? A robed, sceptered presence? A flickering substance with the appearance of shape? I'm here to tell you God was a little Jewish-looking man. He had poor posture, he was nearly blind, and he was wearing a Nehru suit. You're God? Better Satan. But you look like a little Jewish man with poor posture. Like I keep telling you, it's for empathy. Better I should appear as somebody from your background. You're God? I just stared at him, dazed. I can't be sure of this, but the way I was staring, I think I made him uncomfortable. He adjusted the buttons of his jacket. Your clothes, that suit. I thought it looked peppy. God had appeared to me. I sat down on a paint can, shaking my head with wonderment. This is just too much for me. I know. And in your own basement, yet. It's some nifty miracle. And this is what you look like. This is what I look like for you. For somebody else, I would look different. And I'll tell you something, but don't make any funny remarks. I can also be a lady. It was God. I can be any color. I can do any face or any voice you name. I'm a regular David Fry. I have seen God. Look, don't get too carried away. I want to have a nice discussion. He pulled up a paint can for himself and sat down. I was sitting face to face with God in front of the hot water heater, hot stove league style. As we got close, I could tell he was wearing cologne. Canoe. You're like a person, even down to the cologne. I thought as long as I was getting dressed up. I was staring again. Can I touch you? Would I feel you? Oi, oi, oi. No, you wouldn't feel me, and let's not get into a science fiction monkey business about it. We got more important things, like, how's it going? I think it's going very well now. Well, the kids went back to press a few times, that's okay. And the big press conference? Yeah, the press conference was okay. The yelling at the end I could have lived without. And we made page one of the Times. That I would expect. And Time, a cover story in Time. I saw, so what about Newsweek? Huh? U.S. News, McCall's. You're going to stop with Time? It should be the cover of every magazine, everywhere you look. Like with Ally McGraw when she was hot. But I thought... What? God would make conversation with a person and you shouldn't see it everywhere you look? God, who made the heavens and the earth and the doggies and the fishes? Interest is growing. And how come no Johnny Carson? That was my decision. I think I should maintain a certain dignity in this. Dignity? Listen to Ipsy Pipsy him. Readership, listenership is what counts. I just figured in the long run, you could go on Flip Wilson. Flip Wilson? It's a variety show. So, you could stand up in the audience and wave. Some people have William Morris advising them in their careers, not me. If you think so, I'm not telling you what to do, it's just a suggestion. Guess who was going to do Flip Wilson? But plenty of people haven't heard, he said.
I thought to myself, you're pretty hard to please. Maybe you should go on television. He knew what I was thinking. Of course, I could make appearances myself, but we'd only have people dropping dead from hysterics. No, you're my fella, for better or worse, and it's not bad, but it could be better. I'll try my best. That's all I ask. Yes, sir. Sir? What am I, a British knight? You can just call me God. Yes, God. Yes, God. So listen, goodbye for now. It's been good seeing you. How do you reply? It's been incredible seeing you. I was speechless. He waved goodbye and waited for me to leave. I went upstairs, turned to look back, but he was gone. Questions. The Bible sometimes says that God appeared to someone. How did he do it? Was it anything like this? More frequently, the Bible says God spoke to people. How did he do it? And how does God speak to people today?
Well, I think you have fairly characterized, at least in two or three sentences, what one would have to say in terms of the biblical evidence. In the Old Testament, the matter of God appearing has become a matter of reflection and storytelling. The story that comes to mind is the story of the three men who visit Abraham. It's told in Genesis 18. Now, it is not altogether clear who of the three men is God, or whether one should make such an identification. It is as if the one who stands behind it, the divine, both reveals and hides himself in these three men. And one is forced almost to move one's interest from the identity of the communicator to the communication, which evidently is in the center there in Genesis 18. Now that would be one story that comes to mind. Some commentators have commented on this God half hiding and half revealing himself in this story. But of course I could think of other stories as well, and I'm not sure that would be the best way of spending one's time to rehearse them. But it is certainly true that God appears in many ways, in many and sundry ways, as the King James Version has it at the beginning of the letter to the Hebrews. So it's really an affirmation of what you say, what you have summarized in one or two sentences. And evidently with it, the caution not to think that God has to appear only in one way. In fact, I think the Hebrew scriptures warn against such a nailing God down. They call it idolatry.
Are there other modes in which he spoke to them, revealed himself? I'm thinking of dreams. Can you identify just a number of modes in which this happened in the Old Testament?
Again, there is, of course, the Old Testament came together over a long period, and you might expect there changes and even certain critiques internally. When the son of Saul is finally caught having transgressed one of the commandments of his father, we hear in 1 Samuel 14 that God at this point neither spoke through dreams, nor through prophets, nor through Urim and Tumim. You have three different modes of revelation listed, but none of them worked at that point. So here you have them listed. You have some of the prophets, especially Jeremiah, being very skeptical of people who make dreams the vehicle, the medium of divine revelation. But Jeremiah and his fellow prophets have, I think, an axe to grind, and I mean this in a good sense, that they want to contrast the revelation they receive by having stood in the divine council at which they transmit through the word of the Lord as superior to revelation of dreams. What has straw to do with wheat? Jeremiah can then ask. Straw is the revelation through a dream. Wheat is the revelation through the divine word.
All right, we'll come back.
I should say, to start with, that that what I do as a profession, namely the teaching of systematic theology, has to do with, at least a part of it has to do with the question, on what grounds, for what reasons, can we make any kind of statements at all about God? And I think that's a fairly new discipline. I think if we went back 400 years or so, we would find that kind of question was probably not uppermost in very many people's minds at all. The arguments were over where and how God revealed himself and to whom, but not whether there would be a revelation at all. So one could simply pick up the Bible and carry it around as the Word of God. And you might have people arguing over whether or not the Bible or the Quran or something else was the Word of God, but not whether there was a Word from God. I think it's only in more recent times that the whole question has surfaced, in which we now have to ask, on what grounds can we make any kind of statements about God at all? My colleague in Old Testament at Columbus, Ron Halls, likes to say that if he were to do a miracle in front of his class, they would not say, God has visited his people. They would say, do it again slowly. And the reason for that is, you see, that we live in an age now where we would want to say, by what criteria would we even recognize that a manifestation of God has occurred? We have many other possible explanations for almost everything that happens, or at least we think that other explanations are possible, that if given enough time, given enough repetition, given enough exposure to a phenomenon, we are able to give it an inner worldly explanation, or at least an inner universe explanation. I mean, there might be intelligible life out there somewhere that can communicate with us, but we have we no longer ascribe illness to God. We do not rush off to a priest and ask for some kind of prayer or expiation that will once again get us right with God. We go to a doctor, obviously. I was just talking with some doctors about this less than a year ago, in which they pointed out that 400 years ago, to go to a doctor was the last resort. I mean, after you had tried the clergy, and that didn't work, then, and nothing else worked, then you would go to a doctor. You know, you were near death, so it couldn't hurt anymore to go to a doctor. The state of medicine was not exactly one which gave people a lot of confidence in it. Today, it is almost exactly the reverse, isn't it? As a last resort, when we have tried everything else, when we've swallowed every pill, gone to through every x-ray, been to every hospital, and twice to the Mayo Clinic, then we might try a clergy person, you see, and prayer and faith and a few other things. So I think, first of all, that we are in a fundamentally different kind of cultural situation than people were 400 years ago. And I think, in fact, one could probably say that the watershed which divides the modern world from all previous ages is precisely this, that we look for an inner worldly, that is a non-divine, a non-supernatural explanation for virtually everything. I would want to then ask, how would we be able to tell whether materializations even would be signals that we are encountering something that could be called God? Let me just stop there.
Let me ask you, Walter, would you still maintain, and I'm not sure after you have spoken, that we have basically to reckon with two spheres, an inner worldly, or if you wish, inner universe sphere, and then a sphere beyond, and that the issue still is that of the relation between the two?
Well, as a theologian, I would want to say, no, that whole putting of the question, an inner worldly and a natural and a supernatural, that's basically a wrong way to go about it. But now I'm getting into answers, not questions. But I think that up to the modern time, up to, well, you can date it variously. The earliest dating for modernity that I have come across is Machiavelli, who lived the 15th century, but most people are more willing to say that the modern world begins with the Enlightenment or the Industrial Revolution, which maybe takes us back 200, 250 years. And the characteristics of both of the modern world in both its technological as well as its philosophical form has been the denial of the supernatural. So that modern secularism is mostly saying this supernatural world does not exist, or if it does, we cannot communicate with it. But I think what makes language of words from God, revelation of God, or what made those kinds of things meaningful 250 years ago was that they did operate with basically two realms: a natural realm or an inner worldly realm, and a supernatural realm or an extra worldly realm. And since everybody assumed that picture, then the arguments were over how did the one enter the other.
But that's a matter of the past. The supernatural has died. We have to reconceive the Christian faith within the natural realm.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
Okay, well then
now,
I haven't
in that right sense there. Then I do not think, I think that a movie like this or a script like this is great fun, but doesn't really do much more than, let's say, tickle our imaginations again.
Now you see, it's interesting, this is precisely where I would put the place of God language, at the edges of our imagination. I'm almost tempted to say, for the play of it, God is the edge, or are the edges of our language. Mm-hmm. And this is why I think this is not only delightful, but pushes us to the edges. That in very everyday encounters, you know, with a man in tennis shoes, who's the good humor man, there opens up to the eye that looks again a dimension that maybe isn't visible to others. And yet in this discovery, and it's a very individual and personal one, a dimension opens up at the edges of it all, where I would see the possibility of reconceiving the Christian tradition or God language or what have you.
But he still does this in terms of appearing and disappearing and floors that don't exist and yet do for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You see, this is what happens then in my mind, that things do appear and disappear. But I do move to the 37th floor of a building that has only 26 floors. Now, is this real or not real?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say it's very real. It's at the edge of reality. You see how a 37th floor relates to the 26th? It's the edge of it, so to speak. I have this, by the way, in case you're interested in, this is sort of the thinking that you encounter in Paul van Buren's book, The Edges of Language, which I have found very helpful in clarifying some of this matter of God language today.
I think we wouldn't expect answers to the fundamental questions we're asking from a novelist like Avery Corman. So I think indeed it is only perhaps a tantalizing way of putting the question, and doesn't
doesn't help us toward a solution at all, but it raises, in a very interesting way, it seems to me, the question, how does God communicate with people? And just in terms of what you have both said so far, just maybe to focus in on the question, how does God speak to people today? So well, talk about that may be helpful, and then we'll throw
it all right. One possibility is that he does not, that in fact there is no God, and that what we have are a lot of imaginings. It would be possible, for example, to read the whole Hebrew Scriptures and say of it nothing more than that is what they thought. So I would want to say, I would want to at least ask, are there grounds at all for us to even use the word God? And then what are those grounds?
But don't just ask us questions. Now I'll ask the questions. Give some answers. Are there?
Yeah, there have been. I mean, some of the recent Christian thinkers, and not only Christian thinkers, have tried to give answers that do not employ the G-O-D combination. That means Tillich, for instance, when he speaks of the ground of being, is an attempt to do this, you see. Or Bonhoeffer, when he speaks of Christ, and I would think that this is then transparent to the divine as the man for others, the human being for others, we would have to formulate today, in this openness and readiness to lose oneself, that here the divine becomes concrete. Not that you can isolate it and set it aside as an element or a matter, that these are attempts, I think, to answer that question. Some of the contemporary.
Yeah, but one could still reply to Bonhoeffer, though, that when you use the word divine as a subject for saying mm-hmm. anything, you still have not provided a grounding for that usage. So to say, I see the divine in the mountains is really a way of talking about your seeing, not about the divine. Or to say, I see the divine in those who are there for others. Well, that's we're talking about Bonhoeffer's way of looking at things. We are not yet talking about the divine. We have not established that when we use the word divine or God or transcendence, that there is an object for that, or a referent, or something that allows us to say, yes, you are really referring to something that everybody can experience.
Yeah, now here I have to make a confession to Walt and to the rest of you that for me, the separation of the subjective and the objective is no more possible. That I cannot separate the two of them out. Now, let me not fire with heavy ammunition here, but I think the one who has, at least in the area of thinking, to my mind convincingly, and that's why I stand at this point, thrown this very much into question is Heidegger, you see, who has said that we can no more speak of being apart from the one who speaks of being. And in a way, this has so much set the basic framework for my thinking that in the moment in which, you know, the telltale words occur, subject, object, only way of looking or imagining or reference, you see that here I shift out of gear. Now that's all I can say at this point. Anything further, I would have to tread very carefully. But it was really said more by way of confession that these categories have sunk away for me. I can no more speak in terms of the subjective and the objective.
Well, let me use a different set of words then. The difference between a private and a public experience. Mm-hmm. If I say to you, I see God in the mountains, and nobody else does, then I am describing a private experience. And we are very comfortable with that. It's because the thing is, you can't criticize a private experience. If I see something, then I do indeed see it, even though no one else does. And I think a lot of us have responded to the challenge of the absence of, let's say, the universally acknowledged supernatural world. A lot of us have responded to that by retreating into, if not individual private experience, then at least group private experience. And as long as it's harmless, we say, well, you can see anything you want. I mean, who is going to find any danger in people seeing God in the mountains or God in the chipmunks or God in the a rushing stream or a glacier? No danger in that. So we'll let you see that. But I don't see it there. I mean, I say to him, now, what do you see in the mountain that says you see God in the mountain? Well, I see it, I feel it, the person says, and it's very intense. Maybe, but it's not something that can be shared with me. If he says, I see grandeur in the mountain, see, now he's talking about a shareable experience, something I can say, oh, yes, I can experience grandeur in the mountains, too. Or I experience coldness in the glacier. Well, yeah, that's a shareable. It stops being a private experience and becomes a public one. The kind of thing I'm looking for is what aspects of our common experience, our shareable experience, can be pointed to and to which we can give the term God. That's what I'm looking for. When you talk about the edges of our existence, you are talking finally about something that you could demonstrate, if you had enough time, to everyone in this room, and in fact to anyone that you came in contact with. And you could say, that's what we mean when we use the word God. And everybody would say, aha, now we know what you mean with that word. I think maybe that may be better than subjective objective. Private public would be better words. Mm-hmm. The places that I look for, I look at two things for public language about God. The first of them is what I would call those kinds of experiences where we sense ourselves as being controlled without any even theoretical possibility of our exerting a kind of counter-control, where I am totally, unquestionably, unconditionally at the mercy of something over which I have no theoretical control. That would be a God experience.
Example,
birth. None of us can in any way, theoretically even, control our own birth. When we talk about birth control, it is always somebody else's, right? Now, that's fairly terrifying. That is fairly terrifying because what most of us want, perhaps more than anything else, is the sense that we are in control of our motions, our actions, our destinies, our movements. You know, you sit here, you decide. I mean, I can say anything I want, but you decide whether you like what I say or whether you don't like what I say. And you can get up and walk out anytime you want. You are in control, in a sense, of this experience, even though I'm doing the talking. You have you retain some control. But your own birth is one of the areas over which you had no control. And think about now how terrifying it is to think about that. Have your parents ever told you how they almost didn't meet, or how they almost didn't marry? And I mean, that is scary. Or Psychology Today did a series of interviews of so-called sexually liberated young people and asked them, among other questions, how do you feel about your parents' sexual activity? They didn't want to think about it. It was distasteful, unpleasant, something they just didn't want to think about. I ask you now, you know, just sit here for a moment and try to contemplate your own parents having fun in bed, having sexual intercourse. You don't like to think about it. I don't like to think about it. And the reason is, and not only your parents, but the whole parental generation, the people who are ahead of you there, some, the reason for it is because it confronts us with that point in our own existence where we might not be. We might not be. And that we don't like to think about at all. Okay, two other places. The inevitability of our death. It's another thing we do not like to contemplate. I don't remember who said it. Some Frenchman said that death is like looking at the sun. We can't do it, especially our own. We are engaged in what Freud, and I think Ernst Becker since him, have called a causa sui project. That is, I like to think of myself as self-caused, self-generating, hence birth, and infinite in extension. You know, you can imagine your own funeral, but you're always there watching it. See? The insurance companies, when they sell life insurance, they're really selling death insurance, but who can call it that? But when they sell life insurance, I don't know who did this, Sears, somebody, take yourself out of the picture, young man, see, but they put you back before the commercial is over. All right, and the third place where we meet the control over which we have no control is the necessity to choose. We have no choice about choosing. We may make choices within the larger framework of choosing, but we have no choice about choice. For not to choose is already to choose. There is no way out of that, no logical way. I find this very interesting whenever I'm talking to complete behavioral determinists. There aren't very many, but if one shows up, you know, if we really are determined, that is totally determined, totally controlled beings in the area of choice, then why does he want us, Skinner, to choose determinism? You see, it is in a sense its own refutation. He wouldn't have to write any books persuading us, trying to persuade us, that we are controlled if we have no such thing as choice at all. We may argue about the limits and the ranges, but not about the fact, it seems to me. And that whole realm is one way in which we experience God. It is a terrifying way, it is a threatening way, it is a way we do not like to experience God, but it is one way. The other way, I think, lies in the Christian claim that the story of Jesus is, in fact, God's story. Or one should expand that to say Jesus in Israel. And that's quite another way of talking about God, but it is a public way, because it is a narrative, because it is something that is supposed to have happened. It's not a novel, it's not God showing up on the 37th floor of a building that has only 26. But it's something that took place concretely in world history, and for which the claim is now made, this is the story of God's way with the world. So I think in those two ways we have some grounding. The one is the grounding for the Christian message, the other is the grounding for language about God at all. But they confront us with two different experiences, both of them shareable.
That's very helpful. Let's invite you all into the conversation. Now, I've seen a couple hands. Is there somebody back here who had a hand? Maybe not. Nehemiah.
I have heard so many stories about God, revelation, not only in Christianity, but in Hinduism also. People telling stories that God revealed. In those times, I have felt that God didn't belong to me, and God belongs to him. And it was really uncomfortable to think in that way. But I want to think that God belongs to me, God belongs to this world and this part of the century and this history, this politics and this science, this society. So I think as God belongs to history, walking in history, belongs to this nature and world, God need not take supernatural steps to reveal himself. The Son of God lived in history in time. And that's the same way God reveals today in history, in world. And that gives me more comfort to worship God. I am not alienated because God belongs to me in history, in my time. I'm not the criticizing the private experiences, but doesn't speak to me. I thought, oh God, just for fun. Doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Okay. Please?
Maybe either Walter or Dr. Oates could tell me where I'm at then, because this movie and the movie Fiddler on the Roof supported very much deep meaning in my life, and it does from this standpoint. In the Old Testament, where Abraham bargains with this great God of his, Fiddler on the Roof, Topol talks so freely with God, now what, you have to wreck my horse for it, the only one I got. This is the kind of a relationship I feel I have with God, that I can sit in my study, I don't have to go to my knees, fold my hand, bow my head, and offer prayers, but that I can, in a sense, as Topol did, as Abraham did, in a sense, talk with this God of mine.
Yes.
Now, where am I at this point, then? You made a distinction, Walt, between, you said, now the Hebrew Scriptures, you sort of set aside, but said, now the New Testament, of course, with Christ, is something that actually happened. Are you saying then the Old Testament is something that did not happen?
No, I think that the Old Testament happened too, but not quite in...
Why not quite?
Well, let me say, we have to distinguish, Wolfgang can do this better than I can, but I think we have to distinguish between kinds of stories in the Old Testament. I have no doubt that a slave people entered, or a nomadic people at least, entered Cana. I have no doubt that there was David the king and a confederation of tribes that became a monarchy and that they went into exile. The point at which I want to raise questions is not whether or not they had these ideas, whether or not they could talk to God, Topol does, Abraham does, it's whether or not God talks back and how. That is the question. Lily Tomlin, in one of her routines, says, when I talk to God, I'm praying. When he talks to me, I'm nuts. That is the point. You can address all the words you want to God, and we will say you're harmless. If you start saying God talks to me, then we're going to start wondering about you, and if you tell us things that are too dangerous, we're going to put you in a white suit. We're not going to say, he's had a revelation. We're going to put you in a straitjacket.
Well, again, we said the same thing about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, then.
It's very interesting. I don't know.
Because they're saying that God said things to them.
Are they?
Aren't they? You're saying that God said it to them in the Christ when you say it was there, but what about Moses, Abraham, Joshua, all these people? Aren't they as viable, real, as are the men of the New Testament?
It's really in the area between. You have sketched two extremes, Walter. You know, put you into a straitjacket or do you away, and then, you know, otherwise it's harmless. I think in between. I think that we are quite prepared to accept the word of any one of us, thus says the Lord, and many preachers, of course, actually do it in their preaching, provided it does not so radically move outside our own horizon that we are lost, that it disappears. If it widens our horizon, or if you wish, deepens it, we find it acceptable. And I would say, God speaks, God speaks where I can still just take it. And I hear, for instance, the evangelist doing that, each in different ways, you see. In some respects, they're even contradicting each other. But I can still take it, because I recognize in the contradiction between Mark and Matthew, for instance, you see, I recognize a creative tension with which I'm also struggling, between the old and the new, to use that particular example. So I would place God speaking in between your two extremes, at the point where I can just still take it.
I think Lily Tomlin again points up a problem. I don't think that's the solution, but I think that she indicates a problem. I guess what I'm really saying is Billy Graham's answer to the so-called death of God movement, God is my God is alive, I talked to him this morning, is no answer. I do not regard that as an answer. I think that we have to ask, what is the quality of the claim that is being made for the revelation? I think that Jesus does make a claim to be the bearer of a revelation. Whether or not one believes in Jesus is really a decision about whether or not one accepts his claim to being the bearer of the revelation of God. And to be a Christian is really to say that story, the story of Jesus, is the standard by which I judge all other claims for a revelation.
But again, in a sense, that is on the basis of a story by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the same as the story in the Old Testament situation. So I guess this is where, like I say, this is where I feel a very, God is very personal, very personable, I guess, to me. And that's why this movie I found not only fun, but I guess in a sense reinforcing that this is the way God could at any time, quietly address himself. I've never felt God visualizing himself in my office. He does, I'm afraid I'd go out the window like this poor fellow is about to do. But he's very, very personable, very close to me in that way.
I have a question, why God didn't reveal to Karl Marx in that way?
What makes you so sure? I think that God spoke also through Karl Marx. And I think has given to many people very profound insight. That is not to bless, a political philosophy that now claims Karl Marx as its saint. That's, I think, another matter still. But you see, here I think we have to recognize the fact that there are many sensitive, serious people who, like Mr. Rohr here says, thus God spoke. Now they may not want to make this an absolute claim, turn this into an idol, and yet I have to recognize that as part of the total interaction between us within which the divine manifests itself.
Is there a difference between saying God spoke through Karl Marx and saying Karl Marx had many valid insights?
That depends on the community in which I sit. Here I said the first.
Why?
Because I think language is a function of communities. Take, for instance, your earlier example of I see God in the mountain. That makes sense, I suppose, to most of us here. Say this were a meeting of the American Philosophical Association, or American sociologists maybe, that would not make sense. But the second statement would make sense in terms of grandeur is evident in natural phenomena such as the mountains. Only to illustrate that our language functions as that which builds, upholds, delimits communities. We live as communities and individual members of it in the language of that community as in a house.
Okay, then I would have to say, how do you keep a community's language from simply being a private language? How would you communicate your conviction that God spoke through Karl Marx to a person for whom the word God has no meaning, no content? Yeah,
probably not through my words, but through my actions.
Mm-hmm. That's a cop-out.
Not sure, because, you see, I think there are many ways in which we communicate to each other. I think we have in the West, especially since the time of the Reformation, but it has older roots, made the word, the spoken word, and then also the printed word, the exclusive vehicle of communication. And the longer the more, I am afraid of this inliberation, this imprisoning of Christian presence into the spoken or the written word. Fundamentalism is simply an extreme example of that. I think one of the fruits of the Enlightenment, by the way, one of the less fortunate fruits. And so you see why I don't think it is necessarily a cop-out.
I believe God spoke through this author writing this now, in my case, particularly, it brought my attention to a faith that I'd forgotten. And I saw the movie twice, and I went just for pure entertainment because I was very tired of all of the diary-ish type movies that I had seen. And
diary-ish.
It's just language.
My motive for going to the movie was, as I say, very simple entertainment. And I walked out with tears. I encouraged my husband to go back with me, and we both walked out with tears after 15 minutes of sitting there watching different groups of people, some going out with ho-hum, you know, others going out with delight, tittering, and others with tears. And there's a difference in a layman and their knowledge as a theologian and their knowledge. And something like this will bring God closer.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that, Walt?
Oh, goodness.
You're talking to dummies.
No.
That's not the point at all. Mm-hmm. This is very good communication.
I think that all of us have experiences that are real and that are profound, but I'm uncomfortable with generalizations from those experiences unless we generalize in such a way that that the experiences can be shared by everyone. You said that people reacted variously to this movie. I have to keep asking whether your reaction was not conditioned or triggered by something which would at least make it questionable to say God spoke to you through this movie.
Definitely. That's what I was telling you. A tragedy had occurred to me like 2 months before. The movie came about this time. I believe that it was a miracle for me. It started, you were saying that people saw the doctor as a last resort, and now they see the pastor as a last resort. This was true as far as physical,
mm-hmm.
but emotionally, this is also true for it. Emotionally, when you're absolutely the lowest is when you finally see God.
Some people do at that point and others do not, and that for me raises the question. See, you began your statement by saying I believe this was a miracle
for me.
All right, and you qualify it then by saying for me. Could you say it apodictically, just straight out, this was a miracle, and convince all of us? Not qualify it by saying for me or I believe, but this was a miracle.
Maury may want to get in relation to that.
I think this is closely related. I get the feeling from your comments, Walt, that you want a revelation of God, a communication from God, which is understandable and shared by all people, and that would be legitimate God language. That if we could agree, if we were public enough. It seems to me the reason we have so many different religions, different sects of our religion, is that people understand the communication of God in so many different ways, just as we understand the movie in different ways. And that if a community can agree on something, some ritual, which we do in our worship services. We write some kind of worship liturgy we can agree upon and celebrate. That becomes a center for the community, but each person in that community may be in touch with God in different ways, may communicate, may feel some communication that is personal, as you say. if there are enough points at which the community can agree, then we've got a basis for celebration of the nature of God and some kind of understanding of it. But it's going to still be different for each person in that community.
I acknowledge all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, everything you're saying is true, and I acknowledge the story that you're telling too. But I'm saying, if we are going to use, if we're going to attach the word God to those experiences, to the variations and the differences, using that word has to have at least enough common coinage for all of us to have some sense of what we are talking about. I'm not saying that it's that the content of the word God is going to be very big. I'm only saying it's got to have common content. That's what I was trying to do with the birth, death, choice stuff. I was trying to say all of us, every human being, can experience at least that.
That movie was like a first grade reader.
Let me just say we're well into the conversation and we'll continue it tomorrow, and you
tomorrow.
Want to feel free to leave, but there were a few hands up and you may want to, well, maybe just come back.